I wanted to speak about I wanted to speak about population coding as well. So basically, I could have done two talks in 1 hour and a half, but then I realized that it's better to make one talk. And I could speak about population coding for people that are interested in, at a later date in the workshop. All right. So as Peter said a few days ago, we couldn't do anything without probabilities. So we couldn't act, in fact. So for example, if we want to cross a river like this, if we want to jump, the mean doesn't tell us anything about whether to jump or not. If we don't know the variance, we are kind of unable to act, right? So uncertainty matters. Uncertainty is important. And it's still a very open question how the brain represents and deals with uncertainty, right? But we can put this question even further, push it even further, and think of the task we believe the neural structure is solving, the perceptual system. Every single one of them can be understood as a kind of elementary probabilistic inference task, okay? So even the, I think even the operations that are done at a very microscopic level, at the level of single neuron, single cell types, or small population of neurons, can actually be formalized if we have some hypotheses about their function. They can be formalized in this framework of Bayesian inference in an underlying model. So for example, here we can think of analyzing a sensory scene. And if when we think of analyzing a sensory scene, we think of identifying in that scene the elements that compose it, okay? So we could represent these elements, whether they are elementary features or objects, as hidden variables here, which represent, for example, whether the feature is present or not, 0 or 1. And these elements, these features, will have a particular effect on our sensory receptors. So we can think of a feature as predicting, causing, a particular sensory event that we measure at the level of the sensory epitheliums, for example, right? These events are not permanently present or absent. The features will appear and disappear, or they will move in the outside world. So there is a particular, partially predictable way in which these features will evolve over time, which we can represent here as a loopy arrow, which represents the fact that the feature at time t depends on what it was at the previous time step, that t minus dt. And finally, there's not, here we have, if one feature causes many different activation of receptors, then we have to combine cues from these different receptors in the sense that because they are all activated by the same feature, we have to combine information from these different inputs. But that's not the only problem we have to solve, because there's a lot of ambiguities in the sensory input, in the sense that different feature or different objects, or in general different sensory events, will activate the same set of receptors. There's a very strong level of overlap between different objects. And because there's this overlap, because the same sensory inputs can have been caused by many different events or interpretation of the scene, we have to solve this assignment problem and decide whether this input was caused by event one or feature one or event two. If we don't solve this problem, we get into very bad trouble, as I will show later on. So these are very elementary things, detecting object or features that can vary over time and discriminate between features. And I'll show you what we can learn by formalizing the problem in terms of causal inference, like this. So we are interested in which neural structure could actually invert that problem, observe the sensory consequences of these elements in the scene, and infer whether they were present or not. So invert the causal model and determine and interpret the sensory scene in the sense of finding which element composed it, or which features are there, or what are the state of these variables at any point in time, okay? And you notice here that the neural structure is kind of a mirror image of the causal model. In fact, a lot of this inference task can be formalized as passing messages here between observables and variables, and among variables. However, it's not a pure mirror image. You have a lot of more connections here. And it turns out that in order to do inference in a very simple causal model like this, sometimes you have to do very complex and non-local computation down there. And so you can actually have complex neural dynamics, non-linear neural dynamics, that are predicted by simple, very simple, like object detection tasks we believe neurons are doing every day. And that implies here that we have much more complexity than we might initially have thought if we think in terms of simply a neural structure or neural layer detecting objects or features in the outside world. And we will see what this predicts in general for sensory processing in a neural layer. So the simplest problem that a single neuron can solve is basically to detect a stimulus, okay? And this stimulus might be present or absent. So we can represent that as a binary variable, which has state 0 when the stimulus is absent, and then switch to state 1 when the stimulus appears, stays on as long as the stimulus is present, and then switches off when the stimulus disappears. So it's the task of the neuron is then to respond and to track the times when the object was present here. And it's a difficult task because the neuron receives synaptic input, and we know that as stack trains are very variable in the cortex, so to a first approximation, we could say that every single synapse that this neuron receives is modulated by the presence of the stimulus. Some synapses could have higher firing rates when the stimulus is present than when it's absent, and some synapses could have lower firing rate when the stimulus is present than when it's absent. It's a small modulation. Unfortunately, all we observe are spikes that are kind of random samples from these rates. And this is a very noisy observation. You cannot make a decision based on a single synapse. You have to combine from many synapses in order to detect the presence of the stimulus, especially if the stimulus is short, because you don't have much time to make your decision then. Okay. So we can formalize this. So what I described before is called a hidden Markov model. We know exactly how to solve that problem based on a few parameters. One is how strongly the stimulus affect the firing rate of the input synapses here. They're represented by the cues. And how probably the stimulus changes state from 0 or 1 or 1 to 0. That is, its probability of appearing and disappearing that we can represent as rates of switching on and off here. So this completely formalizes the problem, and we can then use Bayesian inference equations and solve it and see how we could update a representation of the probability of presence of the stimulus as a function of the sensory input it receives. And what we get is a differential equation. Why? Because, well, this probability will evolve over time, okay? Because there is this history dependency of the stimulus, its probability will change slowly. And this slow change is represented by a leak term here. The leak term basically brings back the probability of presence of the object towards a sort of prior. Because if you don't observe any input, you will go back to a prior probability of the stimulus being present or not. You don't know anything after a while. Okay, so you have the leak term. And then you have a weighted sum of inputs, because each synapse, whether it's each synapse will either decrease or increase the probability of presence of the stimulus. If you have a synapse that is more active, that responds strongly to the presence of the stimulus, then a spike from this synapse is highly informative and tells you you should increase the probability of presence of the stimulus. If on the contrary you have a synapse that is less active when the stimulus is present, it should decrease the probability of presence of the stimulus. So at the end you have a sort of leaky integration of inputs here, which resembles a form of synaptic integration. Okay? No, it's derived from the Bayesian inference equations by taking the limit for small temporal step dt. So that's how we get the differential equation. Right. You notice it's not linear because probabilistic inference is not linear. The leak term here, I have exponential in it. And it's very important, as we'll see, because this exponential will kind of squeeze the space so that if the probability gets very high or if it gets very low, representing L very positive or negative here, you will have basically an infinite leak. The system will only integrate on a small range of up input. Not exactly, as I will show later. So L is the you could say this is the integrating it integrated input. It's a driving force to the neuron, in a sense. Right. It's not going to be exactly the membrane potential, but it's what drives the membrane potential. Okay, let's think of that as a membrane potential for the moment, and I'll come back to that later. It's sort of the membrane potential of the neuron. Okay, that's my next slide. So it's here. It's the log for the moment. It's the log. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. So it's completely it's a mathematical derivation here. There's nothing biophysical, and the weights here, which are we'll come back to that later. The weights are basically the log of the ratio between the firing rate of the synapse when the stimulus is present, which is its baseline Q0 plus the stimulus-driven firing rate, QI, divided by the baseline firing rate, Q0. So if the synapse is very active, is very much more active when the stimulus is present, QI is high, strongly positive, we have a positive weight. If, on the other hand, it's strongly decreased by the presence of the stimulus, we have a negative QI and a negative weight. All right. So now let's think of how to interpret L in terms of neurophysiology. Here we have our presentation of a particular trial where we have a devolution of L over time. It's very noisy because of the random arrival of excitatory and inhibitory input. How are we going to translate that into a spike train to understand how neurons basically represent this probability? Well, it makes sense to represent information in the output in a way that is the same format than the input, meaning it makes sense to fire spikes so that they can be interpreted as by other neurons as observation from a hidden Markov model, as observation about the stimulus. So I want other neurons to interpret my output spikes as if they were the input spikes, as if they were observations drawn from a probability, drawn from a rate that is modulated by the stimulus. Okay. So if I were to interpret output spikes here as observation from a hidden Markov model, like the synaptic input S, I would basically use the same equation that I use for L here, except that I replace the input by the output spikes. So here we have an interpretation of the output. Each time you observe a spike, you're going to increase the probability of presence of the stimulus. And then as long as you don't observe any spike, you have a decay. All right. So the dashed red line is the readout of the output spike train by another neuron, which interpret the output spikes as observations for a hidden Markov model corresponding to the stimulus switching on and off. So the same way than the input. Yes? So the time constant is not constant, actually. The time constant varies with the dynamic range of the neuron. So you can approximate the time constant tau as 1 divided by r on exponential of L plus r of exponential of minus L. Sorry, the inverse. OK? So the time constant depends on L. It is not constant. R on is the rate of switching on. These are two constant terms corresponding to the speed at which a stimulus varies. So if it switch on and off very, very often, the time constant is short. If it switch on and off very rarely, the time constant is long. But it's also very much dependent on the what you know about the stimulus. If you know a lot of things about the stimulus, L is either plus infinity or minus infinity, and the time constant goes to zero. So if you know everything, you don't integrate. Okay, so the decay will actually be faster and faster, further from the prior.
But it's an L dependent.
So that's actually. Yeah. So. So Lu is sorry, Lu. Blue is the log likelihood ratio, the log probability ratio, the log posterior ratio, more exactly, right? And red is a firing threshold. So we are going to decide to fire whenever we have the log probability ratio of the stimulus, what we know about the stimulus, that goes above what another neurons would know by integrating the output spike train. So it's a form of predictive coding. The neuron will basically decode itself, look at the interpretation of its output spike train, this is a red line, and decide to fire a new spike whenever it's needed to convey new information. So whenever the log probability ratio increases above what's represented by the output spike train. Exactly. It's doing that. Exactly. It's integrating. And then through its spike generation process, it's differentiating again. If there is only one input and one output, there's no computation. It will fire each time it receives an input spike. But you have many synapses. So this, what the system does is it integrates information over many synapses. Yeah. The first part, yes, but okay. L is an integration of all past input spikes discounted for time, dot. And the red line here, which is called J, is an integration of all past output spikes discounted by time. Okay. Okay. Just right. So what we're going to do is we are going to interpret the membrane potential of the neuron as the difference between L and J. So the membrane potential is not L, but it is the difference between L, the integrated input, and J, which is the integrated output. So it's whatever, in a new interspike interval, the neurons basically integrate evidence to decide whether to fire a new spike or not. All right? So V, the membrane potential, is L minus J. And we get an integrate and fire neuron that integrates in synaptic input until a threshold, which is this time is fixed. Then when it crosses the threshold, it fires the spikes, followed by reset, integration, spike, reset, integration, spike, reset, so on and so forth. Yes. That's the way of thinking of G. It would be a neuron that reads only this output spike train and interpret it. So it's like, yeah. So this neuron doesn't exist. The L dependent tau is derived from the equation with the exponential I described before. So it's never actually computed. Oh, I see what you mean. How does the, yeah. You're right. That's right. So there's two possibilities here. Either you decide that this neuron doesn't know tau, it's going to use a generic tau, right? And it will still, if tau is fast enough, it will still track probability, except that this leak being a little bit stronger, it won't be so perfect. But you cannot do that. But you can also learn this transition probability R on and R off. Since they can directly be interpreted as a transition of the stimulus to switch on and off, you can very easily learn them in an unsupervised way. They correspond to the on and off transitions in your stimulus. So we have methods for learning online these transition rates. So if an output neuron tries to read out the spike trains, it will have to learn the transition probability it's true. But once it has learned the transition probability, it can properly decode the output spike train. Yes, so it's if you make J non-leaky, you get a transient neuron. So it will fire. So if the leak of J is very slow, for example, it will fire here, and then it will stop firing. So you get a transient neuron, like a sensory neuron that would have a short So if your readout is assumed to be slower than your integration, you will have a transient neuron. Vice versa, if you assume your readout is faster than your integration, you get a ramp neuron. But here, if you have exactly the same time constant, you get a neuron that fires with a constant firing rate to the stimulus. Yeah, you can think of J as what would be recruited after a spike, like after a hyperpolarizing current, for example. Yeah. All right. So now that we have seen there's an analogy with an integrating fire, we are going to see, can we go the other way? Because here we have a two-dimensional neuron. We have two integration, L and J, that are nonlinear. So if we take the difference, we don't get a single differential equation for the moment potential. It's not equivalent. So if we were to believe to actually transform this neuron into an actual integrating fire with a single equation for V, would that work? And the answer is actually no. All right. Why? Well, great. It's actually due to this this time constant here that is not constant over the integration and range of the neuron. So if we, for example, if we do a stimulus triggered average, STA, of the state xt, so we look at on average what was the stimulus 0, 1 before a spike, we get something that depends, for example, on the contrast. So if you have a very strong contrast, which means that x modulates the synaptic input very strongly, then you have a lot of information and your time constant is very short because L spends a lot of time very positive and very negative. But if your contrast is low, if your stimulus modulates the synaptic input not very strongly, then you have a long time constant. So you don't have a linear integrating fire where all these three curves would be the same. You have a time constant that adjusts to the quantity of information in the input. If you have a lot of information, then it integrates almost, it doesn't integrate. It basically responds instantaneously to the input. But if there's not a lot of information in input, it integrates in a longer time constant because it's necessary in order to detect the transitions. This is the STA of the full model, the Bayesian model. If you do an STA of an integrate on fire, all the three curves would be aligned. And that's data. Yes. So, yeah. So I'm going to go to the second part of the talk. I will speak about networks. So here it's only a single object. Yeah. Yes. No problem. Oh, sorry. I actually advanced. Yes. Okay. So actually, J doesn't really exist. If you want, it's a theoretical construct. That's. Yeah, it's making the model self-consistent. It's like predictive coding. It looks at the difference between the input and a prediction of the input, and only convey prediction error, so that the another neuron could update its belief about the state. Yeah, of course. So for the moment, it's implemented by two equations, one differential equation for L and another differential equation for J, right? Okay, all right. So that's not biological library. So I'm going to speak about that next. All right. I just wanted to emphasize the fact that we actually can't just you know, do a very rough approximation and say that's an integrated fire, okay? Because here we have an example of running the full stimulus, the Bayesian model with two equations, and an integrated fire model that was basically fit to transmit the maximum amount of information about the stimulus. And we see that the blue is a full model, and the magenta is an integrated fire. And the integrated fire has this very long period where it wanders in the negative domain, and it's basically not very good at tracking the stimulus. And in fact, if we look at the information gain, the information transfer, the Shannon information transferred by these models, the full model would be in blue. So here it depends on gain. I'm not going to go through that. But here we have a large information transfer, and the magenta is integrated fire. And we see the integrated fire is not as good as the Bayesian model as tracking the information about the stimulus. But it's still better than a Poisson by LNP neuron, that's a neuron that would just generate spikes with stochastically. So here, what we did is that we took a neuron that was driven by the log odd ratio, by the blue line, like the Bayesian neuron. But instead of firing spike with this mechanism I described before, it's firing spike at random with a rate that is matched to the rate of the Bayesian neuron. So it has exactly the same instantaneous firing rate, but it's very, very bad at transferring information. So it lost most of the information through this random spike generation. So still integrated neuron does a better job, but it's very important that the spikes are actually deterministic in this model. So that's where the integrated fire lose it. It's basically in the transitions, because it takes an integrated fire much longer to detect the transition. When it wanders too much in the negative domain, it takes forever to climb up when the stimulus appears. And that's where most of the information is lost. So the question is, can we make an integrated fire neuron a little bit better at tracking the state of the stimulus that varies over time and doing this computation? And we can if we had two components that we basically derived by rearranging the equation for LMJ. So there are three main regimes in which this neuron behaves. One is just a linear regime. And then there is the regime. So the linear regime occurs when the neuron is uncertain about the state of the stimulus. Its log odd ratio is close to prior, to the prior, to zero. All right? And then there is a regime where the neuron is very certain the object is not present. Its log odd ratio is very negative, which means that it's actually very, very much below threshold. And when this is the case, what we need is a rectifying current here, which will drive back the membrane potential up, will prevent the membrane potential from wandering in this very hyperpolarizing regime here. And this is like an exponential rectification of the membrane potential when it becomes too negative. Yeah? We can get back the log likelihood by integrating the output spike. But we can't derive it from the membrane potential anymore. But we can use the output spike. Well, I could just use the spikes and read out the log likelihood from the spikes. I could read out J. J is very close to L. So I could do that. Yes, it does. It does when it crosses a fixed threshold, and then there is a reset.
So you have a spike in the gene.
Yeah.
So
yes. Not exactly. I mean, it's an approximate. J tracks L to some extent, but it's not perfect. I can't recover L exactly from this equation. This information has been lost. Yeah.
And then so if we do that, it will start with L on the right hand side.
Yeah. So you want the equation?
So you have to take the G, which is the G, and that is the equation of V dot.
Okay. So if you look at the equation, I'm not going to derive the full equation because I would lose like all the time remaining. But if you look at this equation for L here, there is this exponential terms, right? So what I do is I cut the dynamics into three pieces. One where L is close to its to log of R on divided by R of. So basically, when this is close to zero, right? One when L is large, and one when L is small, very negative. When L is large, L and J are basically wandering around each other. The difference between L and J is small. Okay, so I can I can basically linear that it's small, but the time constants increase with J. Okay, so that's how I get this term here, which basically tells me that the larger, I didn't describe this term here. I'll come back to that later. That's how I get this term. When L is very negative, right, then J cannot go below the prior. J is only driven by spike, so if there's no spike, J stays at this constant. L goes very negative, all right? So I say J is constant, and L minus J is basically L, and that's how I get this part here, okay? So I can, do you mind if we meet afterwards and I get through the dirty tricks with you? So I can tell you how good this approximation is here. So here you have the green line is basically the approximation and the blue is the full Bayesian neuron, and you see the green line is not so bad at tracking the blue. Oh yes, I didn't describe you, sorry. Okay, so I told you what happened if you're very negative, if you're very certain the object is not there. When you get very a lot of excitation, you're very certain the object is there, L is very high, then you have an extra term here, which is a form of spike-based adaptation. The more you spike, the more your conductance goes up, and the more your leak increases. So the term that brings back V, that hyperpolarizes V, gets larger and larger as you get more spikes. So it's a form of spike-based adaptation. Sorry? O is the spikes of the neuron. So it's delta. It's a sum of delta functions at the time of the spikes. All right. Activity, yeah. And the more it spikes, the harder it gets to spike because it's more hyperpolarized. Yes. So the way we interpret these two currents is like this would be like a rectifying, like an IH current, hyperpolarization activated depolarizing current. And this would be like either a form of spike-based adaptation, or this could even be implemented after a polarizing current, the refractory period. What was your question? Yes. That's right. Oh yeah. So you can use an adaptive exponential integration fire, for example. We have done that. It's not as good as this model, but it's much better than an integrated fire. All right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, they are not completely closed. It's true, but this regime is not so important because this regime is when the spike the neuron doesn't fire. 500. Here? Here? Yeah, they are on top of each other. Sorry. So the important thing is that the neuron is basically always ready to respond to the stimulus because it cannot go down, right? And when it responds to the stimulus, it doesn't respond like crazy until so it's still ready to respond to the disappearance of the stimulus. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So the blue is exact. So it's the membrane potential of the exact Bayesian neuron. The green is exact. I'm sorry. The green is exact. The blue is. Oh, I didn't. That should be magenta. It's weird. It's a problem of colors. Anyway, the blue is the knockout. The blue is the approximate, and the magenta is the knockout.
Approximate is this two equations.
It's here.
On top of me sometimes.
I know. The color is. The color in the figure is not the same as the color in the.
Sorry. Well, no, green is still green here, but magenta is blue here. I'm sorry. That should be magenta, not blue. What?
Exactly, it's completely different.
Thanks. I just wanted to make something a little bit more biophysically plausible. And to think of the role of the different currents. It's because, I'm sorry, question, right? Because what happened here is that these two currents here depend on the transition rate of the stimulus. Basically, if the stimulus switch on often or off often or not. So the way these two forms of current will be adjusted should depend, should be actually maybe even plastic and depend on the dynamics of the stimulus the neuron deals with. All right? So we can learn something from the biophysics. That's why I'm trying to give a name to these different types of currents. There's a reset. Yes. To basically, if there's zero, the membrane potential is k is k, and the reset is minus k. So it's a fixed reset to minus k. No, it doesn't screw things because there's a memory embedded into this adaptive currents. Oh, in the exact neuron, there's a J term that has a memory. Yeah. Okay. So here we have a neuron that switches between different regimes, one where it integrates near its firing threshold, one when it's excited and waits for transition done. And one where it's inhibited, but not too much, thanks to the rectifying currents, and where it's waiting for the stimulus to switch off, on. Sorry. So that's basically the conclusion slide on inference in single neurons. All right. So now I'm going to extend this. So that's for the moment we have a single stimulus. We have seen that it's only one of the problems that you have to solve, even to analyze a simple sensory scene. So now we are going to switch. Sorry. To what happens when you have more than one object. So rather than having a single stimulus switching on and off, you have a number of stimuli in a scene switching on and off. These stimuli activate the sensory receptors, and these sensory receptors send synaptic inputs to this layer of sensory neurons that have not only to integrate information about their stimulus, but also to decide among themselves which input relates to which stimulus, which is very important. And yes, it's a segmentation of the scene. Why is it interesting? Most of the time when you study a sensory neuron, you stick an electrode in it and then you play stimulus and you look at how it responds to the stimulus. So you look the problem here, but you don't really think in terms of prediction like that. So what's different between basically thinking of the neuron as a filter here or thinking of the neuron as making a prediction there about its input? Yes, that's what it does. Is that okay if I draw? I mean, I have signs of it. So basically, it fires at a low baseline rate when the stimulus is absent, and it fires at a higher rate when the stimulus is present. If you look at the instantaneous firing rate, it's basically like that. If you look at the spikes, they are Poisson distributed, basically. So they have the same statistics than the input. They have easy that are exponentials, they are final factor that is 1, CV that is 1. Not exactly, but close. No. What happens is the neuron is a self-predictor. So if it's even when it's very excited, it's inhibiting itself. So that's why it's always in the Poisson regime. Even if each spike counts, I mean, if you transform that into random spike generation, you lose the information. Yes, you could also have an auto inhibition directly, which corresponds to the reset. Yeah. Okay, so why is it different? Maybe I should pass all that. Okay. Let's think of, so for example, neurons in the primary visual cortex are sometimes thought of as hedge detector. They detect edges in the visual scene. All right? So what does that mean? It means that there is an edge somewhere. The neuron say, okay, there is an edge here which predicts that there is high luminance here and low luminance there. And that's what I'm going to look for. That would be looking for an edge by making a prediction about what this edge will do to my sensory input. It will activate, you know, on the receptor here and off receptor there. And that's what I should be looking for. Right. If you actually measure the receptive field of that neuron and you find this kind of gabble shaped, you can also call that an edge detector because it will respond very efficiently to an edge. Okay? But that will respond to many other things and edges. And I don't think this actually, we can say this is really an edge detector. It's something that responds well to edges. And the two are not equivalent. I think this is a true selectivity of the neuron. So here, for example, let's imagine that we have a bunch of neurons coding for edges at different locations. So one lacks an edge here, the other an edge there, there, there. And they need to interpret the scene. Okay? So if there's an edge here, this neuron will fire maximally. If there's an edge there, this neuron will fire. If there's an edge there, this neuron, and so on and so forth. If you do spec. Oh, that's nothing. Sorry, it should be blue. Well, this would be cis neuron, basically. It's one of the neurons in this population. Okay. Yeah, it's just to represent this neuron inside the population. So if you average all these edges, if you look at the spike triggered average, so if you look at when this neuron is very active, what was the average stimulus? This is spike triggered average. You see that the neurons may respond well when the edge is there, but it won't respond very well when the edges are on the side. If you do spectral average, you find a Gabor type shape like this. And that's because the information on the side of the edge here and there is most informative about the presence of the edge at this particular location. But information that comes from the side here and there are completely ambiguous because they could belong to any edges. So the neuron will basically, the stimulus that really had this neuron is the one that not only activates that neuron, but doesn't activate its competitors. So that's where the two are not equivalent. This is the selectivity of the neuron. That is the way it processes information in a particular context. OK. So let's say now we have two neurons, which represent two stimuli. But these two stimuli predict the same input. the same synaptic input received by these two neurons. How are they going to deal with that problem? So there's an ambiguity here. They don't know which caused what, and they have to decide. And I use a toy model to explain what kind of interaction you want between these two neurons. Imagine you have a world made of chairs and tables. And this chair and tables share a lot of their features, the blue part. And some of their features are not shared, like the green parts. If you had two neurons here integrating all these features together, but not competing, then they would be all co-activated by all the features these two objects have in common, and they will be co-active. So when you see a chair, you see a table. When you see a table, you see a chair. You can't discriminate between the two, because these shared features dominate. However, if these neurons compete, they can decide, because if, for example, the chair neuron detects a chair, it can prevent the table neuron from responding to the features that it explains. So these features are explained by a chair. They don't need to be taken into account, and they can be shunted from the input to the table neuron, so that the table neuron doesn't respond to these features that are already explained. Yes, but these sizers are context dependent. They can't be always there. They depend on the context, because if you think of any single object, they will be overlapped by so many objects that if you cut all the wires, there's no wires left. All right. So if there's, for example, there's no table, we know there's no table in the scene, then the chair neuron should most certainly take into account not only the features that are selective to chair, but also the features that may be selective to something else, because there's so much more information there. Yeah. Okay, if this was direct inhibition between the two neurons, what happened is it's like saying chair and table are mutually exclusive. So if I see a chair, I shouldn't see a table, and vice versa. There is no reason why the presence of a chair should decrease the probability of presence of a table directly. Okay, if they are exactly at the same place, then they may be mutually exclusive, but they could be overlapped in a scene, pretty, whatever. Okay, it's a toy example, right? Yeah. So the problem with mutual inhibition is that it's completely unselective. So each neuron receives a lot of inhibition from each other neuron, and you implement something that's like a winner-take-all. You force only one feature to be present. And scenes are composed of many features, right? We have to analyze the scene, see what's there, what's not. There's not only one object in the scene. So I don't think they should just inhibit each other like this. All right, so that's called input-targeted inhibition. That implements what's called explaining away. It's seeing basically what really caused the input before taking it into account. All right, if we come back to our equation for the single neuron, we had an equation, differential equation, where with a leak term that we're not going to touch, it's always the same thing, plus a weighted sum of inputs. And we have seen that the weights are basically the log of the ratio of the firing rate to expect to have when the stimulus is present and when the stimulus is absent. It's how informative the synapse is. Now what we're going to do is we're going to say, okay, so what do I expect to see when the stimulus is present? I expect to see the baseline firing rate, Q0. The increase in firing rate due to the object, Q1. And also, eventually, an increase in firing rate due to the presence of the other object, if it's there in the scene. Because this other object also predicts an increase in firing rate, Q2. So I'm going to multiply the probability of presence of the second object given the sensory input received in the past times Q2. And I'm going to divide that by the expected firing rate when my object one is not present, which is the baseline plus the prediction from object two. So I have to put the prediction from the context here on the top and bottom part of this equation, on this log ratio. And you see that the stronger is the prediction by the context, the more I shunt the synapse, because the closer this ratio is to 1. And when the ratio is 1, log of 1 is 0. All right? So that's an approximation, but... So it's exact for two objects. But it becomes approximate for more than two objects. So what you can learn are the Qs, Q0, Q1, Q2. So you can learn the cues and you can do online source separation like that. But the weights are varying all the time. So yeah, they vary all the time. That's the point, that the receptive fields vary all the time, in fact, in such a framework. So we can actually, when the small, the changes in firewall are relatively small, so when the weights are relatively small, we get a form of divisive normalization here. So L is updated by a weighted sum of inputs, yes, but the weights are not constant. They are divided by a weighted sum of neural activity in the layer. This neural activity, these P's, are just transforming the log-odd ratio L's into P's, so it's just a logistic function. So a function, basically, of the activity of the log-odd ratio of other neurons. The Wij is actually log of Q0 plus Qij divided by Q0. So it's these are the fixed weights if there was no other object present in the scene. Yes, yes, that's right. It's an approximation when Qi, the Qi is small compared to Q0. Otherwise, we can keep the log. It still works. Yeah, we can replace. So we can use JK. We replace LK by JK, and we're fine. So the lateral. JK was the readout of the output spike train. Remember the that's why it's useful to have a self-consistent model because we know how to decode the output spike train. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Around the Q1 much smaller than Q0, so I divide everything by Q0. I get 1 plus Q1 and Q0 plus. L is here. This P is basically exponential of L2 divided by 1 plus exponential of L2. Yeah. More population code here. I mean, it's really a binary representation, so each neuron represents a different object. That's why I'm not going to speak about population code today. There's a version, population code version of this too. But. How do I get this division? So that's a good question. I mean, here what we have is we have each synaptic weight that is gain modulated by a weighted sum of neural activity. And the implementation is a question. Clearly, we cannot have single synapse being connected by all the neurons in the layer, not in the cortex at least. And we can, what I interpret this is, we can have, for example, lateral cells. So cells that implement these weights here. These cells are connected by the sensory input, and they send information from the sensory input to the output neurons, to the actual detectors, and they are modulated by the neural activity, the network activity. So we need to do that in a network. I don't think we can do that in a single neuron. But that's a possible attempt. And there's reason to believe that such mechanism could be implemented, for example, by horizontal cells in the retina, by lateral connection in the glomerula. There's a lot of examples where you have this kind of lateral transmission of information, and they are modulated in a way that's similar to the way the weights should be modulated here. And go back to that. All right. Okay. So now we need to generate predictions for what we expect to see in sensory neurons. What kind of response property should they have? And in particular, how are the receptive fields, the thing we measure experimentally, how are these receptive fields going to vary with the context? So we need a very simple model because we want to be able to interpret what we see. We want to be able to understand and formalize what we see. So we are not going to use complex predictive field like simple cell-like or complex cell-like. We are going to use very simple predictive fields that are bumps. Overlapping bumps like this. And basically what it says is that the neuron in the top layer predicts a local correlated increase in a receptor activity from the previous layer. In fact, this can capture a lot of different type of computation in the cortex, but here we are going to use this kind of constant depth so we can interpret our result. So that's the predictive field. So this is a QI as a function of I. Okay. So it's the increase in firing rate caused by feature I in the receptor layer as a function of the position on the receptor layer. It's not completely stupid to use some bump, because if we do learning, if we learn this simple binary model and natural images, we find bumps like this. I mean, not very surprisingly, because there's so much correlation in images. If we filter the image through Gabors, we also find bumps. And I think if we filter with many different types of filter, we would also find bumps because of the local correlation in visual input, natural visual inputs. All right, so that's an example of the running of this simple toy model. Here we had objects. So when the blue is there's a blue line in the mirror, the object blue is present. I color code the object here. So object blue, then object green as a function of time, then object yellow, etc. This is the receptor unit response. So when an object is present, it increases locally the receptor unit response in its large bump here. And so we can see in gray coded the firing rate of this unit. In black are the spikes. This is a very noisy input. It's very hard by eye to decide which object is present. This is the output of the detectors. So these are their spikes on a particular trial. So I show this sequence of objects, and that's the output I get. The blue neuron is firing when the object blue is present. The green neuron is firing when the green object is present. The yellow neurons is firing. So be careful. This is color code here. It's graded. So in fact, there's not a single object, a single neuron that's active. But there's a local pool of neurons that are active for objects that are similar to the object presented to the network. All right? This is, when I repeat this on many trials, this is a PSTH of this neural population. And you see that when an object is presented, you get a short transient response here. And this response is relatively unselective. Here you have a lot of dark blues and light blues that are activated at the same time. Here you have a lot of yellows and greens, etc. So it's not very selective, this first response. But then it gets more and more selective, and you have a decay of all responses. But you have some neurons that survive this decay better than others. And these are the neurons that are the most selective to the object presented to the system. Okay. This is the probability, so encoded by this network activity. So you see that the probability of the blue object increases when the blue object is presented, and then the green object, and then the yellow object. But it's not perfect. Because of the noise, the system cannot determine exactly which object is present. There's some uncertainty that there's several detectors that are activated at the same time. However, it still does a much better job than the feed-forward network. So if we didn't have this lateral inhibition I described, this is what we would get. Basically, the system is just filtering the input, and you get a lot of neurons active together. The system cannot discriminate between objects if it doesn't have this inhibition. Yeah. Here. Well, here I used the naive. I just had the same feedforward weights and no inhibition. I could also use center surround, like the correlating weights, but it still doesn't work very well because you get all this kind of interference pattern. It's also very bad. All right. So what do we expect to see if we basically apply, you know, sequences of stimulus? Here, if remember the chair and table neurons, if they didn't compete with each other, each time we show a chair or a table or a ladder, these neurons would tend to be coactive because they share a lot of these features. They share a lot of their features. However, thanks to this inhibition here, they kind of basically ignore each other, and the chair neuron can respond on the table neuron can respond on the table, the general chair, and so on. So we expect basically responses that are weaker on average than they would be if there was just straightforward processing, and that are much more selective than they would be if there was just straightforward processing. And indeed, we find that the cross-correlation between neurons in our model is greatly reduced by the presence of inhibition. And this decorrelation occurs thanks to information coming from the entire scene. Okay? So for example, if we take a neuron and we just restrict the input only to the portion covered by its predictive field here. So only the portion that it received direct feedforward input from. And we basically shut down activity coming from the surround of this predictive field. Yes. Oh, that was probably an error. It should not. There should be three curves here, and the ladder should respond with a chair, but not with a table. You're right. Yeah. Okay. So if we aperture the stimulus so that it only shows what the neuron directly is connected to in the scene, then this is the type of response we get. We get a lot of activity here, relatively unselective. And if we look at two nearby neurons, a blue neuron and a red neuron that are both coding for object in this portion of space, they are basically firing at the same time. Okay? Now, if we use a full field stimulus, or if we much widen this aperture here, so that we show all the receptor activity, even the one that comes very far away from what this neuron is pulling information from, so if we show the surround, the full context, then the activity becomes much more select, much more small, much more sparse, and much more selective to different features. All right? And this is equivalent, this is similar to what you see in the primary visual cortex. This, for example, in this experiment, for example, they showed a natural movie either in the receptive field of the V1 cells or in an aperture four times wider. And they recorded from two V1 cells, for example, pairs of V1 cells that had receptive field in the center here. And that's the response of one cell. What you see is that you have a much more activity when the small aperture than for the larger aperture. Their response is much sparser for the larger aperture. And if you look at the response of two cells, they are much less similar for the larger aperture. So there's much more decorrelation when you show the full field, the full movie, even if it's very far from the receptive field of the cell, than if you just show things in the receptive field. Yes, you're right. Actually, no, sorry. Go on. Mm-hmm. I'm going to show the spectral average very soon. To come back to Peter's question, not exactly, because here it would basically you would have an improvement that only covers the center and the surround, immediate surround. But here you get an improvement on the entire image, so even things that are not in the surround. Okay, yeah. But how do you implement a non-classical surround? I mean, it's a way of implementing a non-classical surround. Maybe, that's possible. I will show things that are not consistent with a classical surround. All right, so the spectral averages. So if you do a spectral average of the system, so that's basically spectral average at time zero, and here that's spectral average at larger delays between the spike and the stimulus. So one line is one spectral average at a particular delay here. You see that you get a center surround structure that is implemented by this competition, and that the center is much smaller than the predictive field of the cell. And the surround covers part of the predictive field, but also part of the surrounding area of the predictive field. So this center surround here are the sign of decorrelation of the stimulus. But also, they don't have the same shape depending on the delay between the spike and the stimulus. So for longer delay, longer integration time, you get more surround interaction here. So compare the thick line and the thin line. You get more surround, stronger surround for longer delays and sharper center. So the receptive field sharpens over time. The inhibitory surrounds strengthen over time before they go back to zero. So that's something that was reported, for example, in V1, that's the on part of a V1 simple cell receptive field. And you can see here the sharpening very fast, actually very short this period here, but you have a fast sharpening of the on center that is mainly occurring during the decay phase of the transient, like it is in our model. So we can also test what happened when, rather than looking for longer delays, we increase the contrast of the image. So we can decide to give a lot very noisy input. Each object increases only the firing rate by a little bit, or a very reliable input. Each object has a huge impact on the receptors. So when we increase contrast, this is what happened. We test the receptive field by another method. It's not spectral average, but it's a growing stimulus. So you activate a pixel in the center, and then you grow the size of the pixel that you activate. And so what you expect to see is an increase in activity as you activate more and more of the receptive field. And then when you get into the surround, you get a decay in activity. So the size of this peak here tells you the size of the receptive field. It's another standard method for measuring the visual receptive field. All right? And if we do that at different contrast, for high contrast, this peak here is relatively occurs relatively fast, so a relatively sharp stimulus covers the excitatory part of the receptive field, and when you get into the surround very quickly here, but as you decrease contrast, you get the motion of this peak here to the right, which means that it takes a larger stimulus here to activate the central receptive field, and you get later in the surround. Okay, so that's a sign that the receptive field is actually wider for lower contrast stimuli. So you can also do that with frequency. You can show stimulus of increasing frequency here, and there's a preferred frequency corresponding to the size of the receptive field. And this, for lower contrast, this preferred frequency gets lower. We can also do that with stimulus intensity for different size, small stimulus versus large stimulus. I'm not going to go through that, but it's just another way of showing the same thing. And these all correspond to data, observations that we made in the retina or in the primary visual cortex. Here, for example, these are data from CNAC from 1998 and 2001 for receptive field size and for spatial frequency preference, and that's for the small versus large stimuli of increasing contrast. You have a crossing here, so that small stimuli, basically the cell prefers small stimuli at large contrast and prefer large stimuli at low contrast. Yeah.
Basically, your model can create what is the biophysical substrate.
So here, basically, it occurs because these weights are modulated by the surround activity, the synaptic weights. And the synaptic weights are more shunted. When you get more information, you can have more discrimination between objects. So your competitors will be activated more at higher contrast. They will compete with you, and they will only let you respond to a small range of inputs, the ones that are really in the center of your predictive field. The rest will be shunted, because it can be explained better by other detectors. Okay, so you get a shift from integration detection of the stimulus when all the cells are just trying to detect, respond to anything because there's not enough information to make fine discrimination, to discrimination at high contrast where they really compete with each other. And if you push it to the extreme, there's only one pixel the cell will respond to, is a central pixel. But you really have to push it to the extreme. The synaptic weights are where this WIJT. Right, and you can see that as a shunt directly of the synapse. I think it's more likely that they are just lateral connections that are recruited or not. So that this would be like lateral connection or lateral cells that are recruited only at low contrast or for short stimuli, and are quickly shunted by the network activity at high contrast or for longer times. They are changing. the effective weights, which is, if you remember, it's Wij, which is fixed, divided by 1 plus sum over k of Wij Pj. And you can call that Wij t equal, or tilt, maybe. Well, you could have like dendrites that are shunted by activities, even if synapses tend to cluster with when they have similar selectivity, for example. Yeah, you could do that, I guess, to some extent. If you have a horizontal cell, all you have to do is basically inhibit them when you get a better prediction of these weights. So you don't need shunting. Right? See? I'm not sure I want to commit to a specific biophysical mechanism by now, because I think they would be different in different sensory systems, for example, even in different layers in different sensory systems. All right, so we go from discrimination to detection, from detection to discrimination, from large receptive field with no surround to small receptive field with large strong surround, when we increase contrast or where we increase integration time or when we decrease sensory noise. So that's why you don't have a constant receptive field, and it will depend strongly on the way you actually record it. But that's even worse than that. So for the moment, what I described could still be accounted for by some kind of center surrounded architecture with playing around with the strength of the surround. But if you look more carefully, you find that the receptive field is completely reshaped by the context. So for example, if you activate detectors on the right here, they will compete with the right part of your predictive field, and you will push the receptive field to the left. Vice versa, if you activate receptor to the left, you push the receptive field to the right. All right? So there's an analogy with the chair and table and nadir example. If you show a table and a chair, the two objects compete for the seat of the chair. And as a result, this chair neuron will respond mainly to the head. Sorry, the back of the chair, which is not explained by table. If you show chair and ladder at the same time, it's the other way around, the back of the chair is ambiguous, so the cell won't respond to it, but it will respond to the seat, which is not ambiguous in this particular context. So that would completely change the receptive field as a function of context. So there are examples that could be put into this framework in vision, though I think these effects would be much even more stronger in other modalities where there's more overlap, like audition. But here, there are some examples in the literature of center-surround interaction in the primary visual cortex, where the game is to show some orientation in the center of the receptive field and in the surround of the receptive field, and look at how the surround affects the center. Okay. So there's been some early work from Civito's lab, but now they are kind of controversial because apparently they were not reproduced in such a strong way. But what they found is that you could actually change the response, the tuning of the center to the central orientation when you show surround of different orientation. So basically the surround maximally suppresses the cell when it's co-oriented with the center. And as a result, depending on whether the surround is vertical or horizontal, the tuning curve of the cell is orthogonal, it prefers the orthogonal orientation. But that's a very extreme example, but it's actually a weaker effect is much more common in complex cells. In V1, that's another, it's a Tony Motion's lab, and here they showed that basically the maximum suppression from the surround comes when it's co-oriented with the center, and not, as you would predict in a classical surround model, when the surround is at the preferred orientation of the cell. Okay, and that you can explain by a simple interaction in our model. What happens is the surround predict part of the central input, the part that it's most similar to, and this will push away, this will suppress basically the cell when the same orientation is shown in the center, but not when a different orientation is shown in the center. All right, that's how to test this. If you have questions, I'll do. What's going on? Okay. Now, the last part is about adaptation. So you can look at this effect over space, but you can also look at this effect over time. So if you show a stimulus for a while here, you increase the probability of presence of the stimulus, of course. And when the stimulus switch off, you won't detect instantaneously this disappearance of the stimulus because it's a noisy input, it's an integration. And so the probability of the stimulus will decay slowly over time. And if you show a test stimulus right during the period when before the decay goes completely to zero, you will have still competition coming from this phantom stimuli, this past stimuli, to the new input. And that will predict effect on perception and on sensory responses that I'm going to describe here. So first, the effect on sensory responses. Here we have the tuning curve of two different cells, which is basically the activity, the firing rate, the output firing rate of these cells to a test stimulus at different location compared to the adapted stimulus. The adapted stimulus was at this location, and the test stimulus is varied over the entire range of possible position here. And we look at the firing rate of the cell in response to the test stimulus, the total spike count in response to the test stimulus here. And you see that the cells are maximally suppressed, their response is much weakened when they are the test stimulus is at the similar location to the adaptive stimulus. So basically, when they prefer, it all depends on it depends on two things. First, the reliability of the test stimulus and the adaptive stimulus. So when it's more noisy, remember the time constants are longer. But it also depends on the assumption you make about the adaptive stimuli. If you suppose the adaptive stimuli is slow, which might be the case if you show it for a very long time, then it tends to be slow. Then the probability will decay to zero much slower than in your assume it is fast. So the response of the cell are maximally shunted when their preferred position and the position of the test of the adaptive stimuli, and this decays over distances between the two, which is what you observe also in most sensory layer, not sensory areas, not all. We can have a discussion after that, but most of the time this is what you see, and this suppression is maximum at the test stimulus, okay, at the adaptive stimulus location. That's what you see on neural responses. What do you see on perception? So remember that this neural layer is like as a perceptual interpretation of the scene. So we can interpret its output as the perception of the subject that has in this neural layer. Okay? So what you see in adaptation is basically repulsion. So for example, if I show you a vertical orientation like this for a long time, and then I switch it off and present you quickly another orientation that is a way that is different from this adaptive stimulus, what the percept is basically a repulsion. So you see the test stimulus repulsed away from the adaptive stimulus. I'm sure we have all seen that at some point in presentation. It is called the tilt after effect. It's very strong. Okay? So here, adaptation will repulse your percept away from the adaptive stimuli. And for Bayesian, at first sight, it can appear weird, right? Because you adapt to a stimulus, so increase its probability, and then you show another stimulus, you might thought that the next stimulus will be kind of biased towards the adaptive stimuli, because the adaptive stimuli is just more likely, more probable. But this is not what you see. You see the other way around. You see repulsion away from the basically adaptive stimuli, the one that was presented for such a long time before that. This is also what you see in the model. You actually see a repulsion of the position of the perceived position of the test stimulus, the neuron that's most active in response to the test stimulus, away from the adaptive position. Why is that? How does that work? So we have looked at basically what happened in the probability. So this is the probability of presence of different objects as a function of time. This is a test stimulus presentation, switch off adaptive stimulus, the adaptive stimulus presentation, here, switch off, then we present the test stimulus. Okay? So during the presentation of the adaptive stimuli, nothing very surprising. You have an initial sharpening and then an increase in the probability of presence of the adaptive stimuli, right? So the neurons representing the position of the adaptive stimuli is very active. Then you switch off. This is the probability of the neurons. This is a readout from the output spectrum. It's a good question. I think we would, actually. Because the problem is that this model neglects the correlations between objects. And I actually think that this bias would be greatly decreased in an exact model. But I haven't tried it yet. All right. So what happened after you present the testimonies is something weird. First of all, there's a kind of a revival of the probability of the adaptive stimuli. Because, in fact, this testimonies is pretty close. So it can support the presence of the adaptive stimuli. The adaptive stimuli is still a little bit likely, and so you get some new input and say, oh, the adaptive stimuli is still there. Okay? So you have a peak corresponding to the adaptive stimuli. And then you have a secondary peak here corresponding to the test stimulus, because the system sees that there is a test stimulus there. But it misinterprets this test stimulus as being composed of two parts. One part is the adaptive stimuli that are still present, and another stimulus, that is a test stimulus, that is actually repulsed away from the adaptive stimuli. So the real location of the test stimulus is here, and the secondary peak here is pushed away from the adaptive stimuli. So the system is basically doing this. Rather than perceiving this correct orientation here, it perceives a superposition of two features, one that is at the orientation of the adaptive stimuli, that is assumed to be there in the background, basically, and another, but more tilted object, which is what the subjects report, the orientation of the test. Yes, the psychophysics. So if you look at the psychophysics, you get exactly this curve. Well, exactly. I didn't do data fitting, right? But you get the maximum bias for orientation around the adaptive stimuli, and you get that decays relatively quickly. Bimodal? No, you don't have bimodal percept. So the idea is later on, this activity, these are relatively early sensory processing. You just detect features present in the scene, and then you could have an interpretation later on that concentrates on the test stimulus that, you know, basically doesn't have knows that there's only a single object there, and interpret this secondary peak here as a test stimulus. Yes, it does in this. We can play around with the parameters to get this effect less strong, but yeah, it tends to have a slightly lower probability. You know, I think that a better model would have to have basically here the representation of the test and adaptive stimuli are on the same time scale, and that's why we are like this. The both test and adaptive stimuli are assumed to be as fast. But I think that the adaptive stimuli is more likely recruiting system that assume slower dynamics. And because it's slower, it will compete with the test stimulus without having to be more probable than the test stimulus. So I think we can make this look better if we have different time scales in there. Yes. Yes. Yes, but here I need to revive it completely, or if it decayed slowly, even if it didn't receive some new input, it would still compete with the test stimulus. Even if it didn't grow again, it would still compete, but it would have to be slower than the test stimulus. It's a pretty technical. Yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah, you're right. So you're right that the relationship between this and perception is not totally obvious. Yeah. All right. But I have to say something. I mean, this effect of adaptation, if you take the visual adaptation to visual motion, for example, this effect of adaptation, this decay in the response on the visual response is mostly observed at the level of V1. But if you get to another layer that is empty, the next processing stages in motion, then you get, on the contrary, an attraction of the visual response towards the stimulus, which is like having a population code for orientation pushed away. And I think that basically that the empty layer interpret not directly does the same thing than V1, but interpret much more the scene, not as being composed of many features, but of a single one, and that's where the difference is. Yeah, that's what you would get in a population code, yeah, not in a feature detector. All right, so I'm basically done. So the take-home message from this talk is that predictive fields are invariant, but receptive fields are defined by the context. To give you just a few teaser, the example I showed, there was a very limited overlap. I mean, there's just local overlap between the causal fields, predictive fields, and they have the same dynamics, and they have symmetrical weights, which means that the dynamics is relatively simple and easy to understand. But here, what I did is that I assume random, basically I randomize the predictive field. I said the predictive field look like, you know, noisy, or at least not a topographically defined fluctuation in the sensory responses activity overlapping. And there can be different dynamics. Some objects are slow, some objects are fast. So you could think, for example, of olfactory processing. There's no obvious topology. Each odorant activates a lot of receptors. They overlap. And some odorants might last a long time. Others might be shorter. That's the dynamics you get. On average, this is the average probability of the different objects. I present a stimulus here, basically one of these objects here. And I show it for a while. You have a very complex dynamics arising here. Some probability go down, some probability go up, some probability go up and down. Right? So you have all sort of dynamics in there that are due to the fact that the system basically accumulates more information and change its mind and finally find the right solution. If you look at the receptive fields, forget it. They look completely different whether you look at the beginning or in the middle or at the end of the stimulus presentation, right? So if you were to measure the receptive fields, you'd never be able to make sense of what's going on here. And if we think of other modalities and vision, we are very much concentrated on vision, but if we think of audition, for example, any kind of sounds that have any kind of meaning, apart from maybe pure tone, activates basically the entire cochlea in a very strongly overlapping patterns. And in fact, auditory cells, if you try to predict the auditory response to natural sounds from their receptive field, you don't, basically. It's like 10 or 15% of the variance that can be accounted for from the receptive field. And that may be because basically auditory processing has so much degrees of overlap that the receptive field become meaningless, basically. All right, so just quickly, how would you measure predictive field? Because this is basically the point here, that if you want to understand sensory processing, you need to determine what the predictive fields are and not the receptive fields. How would you do that? So first of all, you want to use bad stimuli, right? Rather than using high contrast stimuli that drive your cells like crazy, that recruits a lot of competition, you want to use low contrast stimuli that don't drive your cell very much, that are near threshold, so you basically don't have competition. Like, for example, for low contrast. The problem is that it's not going to be always possible, because if you don't drive your cell, you don't have spikes. Good luck to measure spectral average, right? Maybe you can do that by intracellular recordings, by patch clamp, but you can't do that by extracellular recordings. But you can try to use tricks like this. It's kind of a progressive construction of a predictive field. You start by measuring the receptive field like you did before, and then you lower the contrast of your stimulus until it's just below the response threshold. Then you do spike triggered average again. You try to revive this response. And at least in the simple toy model I tested, you get a wider predictive field, the receptive field something a little bit closer to the true predictive field. Then you lower the contrast again until below threshold. Then you do spike triggered average again, so on and so forth. So what you do here is that you first look at what drives the cell most efficiently, the center, the very center of the predictive field. Then you lower the input you give here. You give an advantage to the cell, but it's just not enough to make it fire. Then you try to resuscitate the response by activating more and more and more. And this, at the end, you will have to activate the entire predictive field to resuscitate the response of the cell. That's a possibility, but I agree it's not easy. Finally, I mean, of course, multi-electrode recordings would allow us both to test the model and to actually determine what the predictive fields are, because the way different cells interact will depend on the overlap of their predictive fields. So, for example, the blue and the red cell here, if you activate the blue cell by a flash here in its predictive field, then you will suppress response of the red cell to things in the overlap. But you won't suppress response for stimuli that are not in the overlap of the blue and the red. Right? If you record from the blue and the green, same story, same, et cetera, et cetera. So the way the cells interact in their response to stimuli should allow you to reverse engineer the predictive field. And the last thing is, when we want to, when we look in IT, in the infrotopical cortex, for example, for response to visual features, we want to have a strong, strong response like this when we show the stimulus right away. And this response should be strong and reliable. However, in this model, the selectivity builds up over time. So, for example, if you have a neuron that's selective to this French actress here, it will respond initially to everything that is a little bit related to a face or a person, because that's already giving information about the presence of this actress. However, this activity will be suppressed very quickly if it's very far from the preferred object, a little bit more slowly if it resembles the preferred object. And it's only later on in the response that you have a true selectivity that emerges. So I think we should look at the selectivity of the later response. We should try to increase the transient response of the cells rather than just looking at their spike count, because I think it's just more informative in this framework. All right. No idea. I have no idea. I'd like to have a look. I don't know. I mean, this temporal profile, yes. I mean, if you look at, sorry, oops. If you look at response in IT, there's, or in the prefrontal cortex in general, for example, you can see there's transient response and there's sustained response. And I mean, by eye, you see there's different types of response. There can be also more complex dynamics in there. That's all I can say. For all right, I should stop. But the last point is, what this means is that basically expectation redirects sensory flow. So if you expect to see this particular stimulus or particular type of stimulus in your scene, even if you give feedback or attention to this particular type of stimulus, you will basically capture the interpretation of part of the sensory scene, because they basically are explained by your preferred stimulus or the kind of thing you pay attention to. These features are explained, so they won't be able to be processed by other interpretation that you don't favor with your prior. Okay? So if you expect particular things, you might not be able to process everything that can be explained by this expectation, because it's just shunted away from sensory processing. On the other hand, if you have a new input but that doesn't change your expectation, then it's shunted, it's explained already, and you won't maybe even perceive it. So an example here is the well-known example of change blindness. It has nothing to do with early sensory processing, but it's kind of neat. If you look at this image, do you see a change? Right, so if you know, if you have seen it before, you see the change here. There's a huge change, and you don't see it because it's just another plane. So the interpretation is, it's just this sort of input is explained. It's not even processed by the sensory system. Okay, so I want to show you the people that did the work. So there's Tim Lokman here, and Martin Berlin, Udo Ernst, Nabil Bouaouli, and Gianluigi Mongillo. This is a group for neurotheory in Paris. So we have three PIs, as Christine Mackens, Boris Gutkin, and myself. And the group is growing, as you can see in this next picture. And we have a lot of funds in our retreats, but we are actually in central Paris. So if you want to come visit us, we'd be very happy to show you around. Thank you. So you know, for direction, I would more use a population code approach, a little bit like what Peter presented. The reason is you can only have one direction at a time. This model is based on the assumption you can have n features there, and you don't know which features is present. If you deal with a single variable, a single state of a continuous variable like direction, then you can do that with population coding, basically a population of neurons that together represent a probability density function. And I'd like to present that, but I just couldn't do it here because it's too much. It has very different prediction. It has very different prediction in the sense that you don't see this sharpening anymore. You see it's like a classical population code, gain modulated by the precision of the input. But you can have this like change in direction thing, of course, because you can represent the fact that the variable can change over time.
No, that's right. Yeah. But if you see a rotation, the
it depends what kind of dynamics you assume for the dynamic variable. If you assume the dynamic variable should follow some sort of Brownian motion, continuous motion, then you'd see a shift. And if you I mean, it's not the experimental that I assume this, it's the monkey. I mean, if the monkey has a representation of the statistics, dynamics of the variable corresponding to continuous motion, then it will shift that way. And if it thinks it can just jump, then... Thanks.